This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with a personal price plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 720. This is a bonus episode, which means what, Katie?
It's extra. It's extra special.
Well, it also means that we're not...
Bonus.
Yeah, there's bonus, but there's also no sponsorships
there's
on
no sponsors.
So we're just going to make this super quick and say this is episode number 720 with Bobcat Goldthwait, and he has a movie called Call Me Lucky. So go to callmeluckymovie.com to find out more info and where you can see it. And Katie, let's just start the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome, B-Cat, G-Thwaite.
Thank you.
That was a weird way to get into the... You were great at midnight. Thank you so much for joining the show.
Oh, I was a little numb, so thank you. I'm glad it went well.
Are you feeling better?
No.
Of course not.
I'm feeling horrible, but I'm good. I'm doing the show. Hey. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. You just work... It's that thing. You go to work, right?
Yeah. Can we talk about it a little bit?
Sure, of course. We can talk about anything.
Today's the one-year anniversary of...
Oh, my friend Robin Williams passing away, and I truly had no idea that it was going to affect me today. I don't know why, because I've had other people pass away in my life, but I think it was, I've been promoting the movie and just getting, I don't know, you know, it's been hard. It's been really hard today.
I completely understand. As I've talked about many times on the podcast, I lost my dad a year and a half ago, and it is the strangest thing that you will be fine, and then all of a sudden... it's like his birthday was just in July,
yeah.
and then you just get really sad. It's this really deep sadness that doesn't really feel. It's like, where's that coming from? Oh, right, there's an anniversary. Usually, when I feel that sadness, it's like my body knows that something's going on.
Yeah, and that's when you say, I really feel like it was like a sense memory thing. You know, like the time of year and everything hit me. It was, you know, I actually finished the documentary, the last shot in the documentary, and checked my phone message and found out that he had gone. So, yeah, I mean. I've talked about this year, you know, my best friend died, and then I went through a divorce, and then my girlfriend and I broke up decorating the Christmas tree, but at least I had my documentary to edit for 12 hours a day. It's the worst fucking year ever. It was terrible.
Oh,
it
no.
Was, and today, and you know, I've been talking about it, and I didn't talk too much ever about Robin out of respect to his children and his wife and family and everybody. I was too busy helping other folks and processing it all myself when he initially passed away. I didn't really care about doing press, but I do occasionally have someone will come up and they'll go, "Hey, did you know, hey, you were friends with Robin Williams, you know, did you ever talk about suicide? And I'm like, well, we're, you know, we're comedians. We talked about suicide for 30 years, you know. Occasionally we would talk about other stuff, you know. It's like, yeah, hey, you won an Oscar. Congratulations. Yeah. How would you do it? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. An automobile? You know, so, you know, his coroner's report came out and he had Lewy body dementia, which is a form of dementia. And I'm not a doctor, but I'm comfortable saying that I witnessed for the past couple of years the definite effects of him having an actual dementia, you know, him not processing reality correctly. And he was going to a number of doctors and he was doing everything people do for forever, you know, things. And I don't know if it was, I do believe that this dementia was just another thing that him in the middle of the night, you know, that I don't think the decision was made in reality, you know, so that's my own personal opinion.
And is this condition genetic or is it something that is a byproduct of something else that you're aware?
I don't know how you get it, but it's a similar to Parkinson's, and that's why they often think people with it have Parkinson's, you know. And he may have had Parkinson's. I don't know. We were at a few years ago, we've been playing basketball with it wasn't Special Olympics. But it was these guys who and girls who were mentally challenged, and there was a doctor there, and they could tell by Robin's gait that, you know, had said, you know, he should be checked out for Parkinson's. By the way, he was walking. For the record, those kids won. They kicked our ass. And it's like, you know what I mean? It was like we were the Washington Generals, you know? It's like, you know, it doesn't matter. You're going to win. I'm not going to, you know.
Well,
boy, we kicked that Special Olympics team's ass in your face. But then there was really kind of funny because some of the guys were kind of bro-y, you know, and they were serious. Like the first wave of the team were the kids that were like me, you know, in school. And then all of a sudden these really jockey guys got in there and started playing serious
kicking
ball.
Kicking the shit out of you
guys.
Yeah,
it was funny. Yeah.
I mean, do you think he was aware that something? He must have been aware that something
was going on. And we all were. You know, he's a brilliant mind and having a hard time with dialogue and, you know, all this stuff was hard for him, you know. It was really hard.
And I would imagine also, you know, when so much of your, especially him in particular, so much of who he was and how people saw him was like this
right.
lightning fast brain
right. Right.
that was, you know, that was just on point and super right. laser focused. And I mean,
I can't imagine how frustrated I am when I can't call up someone's name quickly or I do the classic old guy thing of walking into a room and my daughter will go, "You forgot why you came in here, didn't you?" And I'm like, "You're a dick." and yes, I did. "Quick, Dad, why are you here?" I love you. I just wanted to say goodnight.
You're lying.
I was, not to get off, you know, but it's funny. I will tell Robin stories because, you know, it's like people talk. I don't have Robin stories per se. Here's a guy who we text and call each other almost every day. And, you know, I just have a life with him, you know. But all my stories are about me kind of like I could use some bread. And he did the Snickers commercial. So he called me up. He's like, you know, so I got you, you know, on the Snickers commercial with me, you know. And he, by the way, he hated people doing impressions of him, but he really did. He really did. But he said, so he called up and he said, he says, "But you know, I'll try to do it well. But you're going to have to do the voice. Are you okay with that? They're going to make you do the voice." And I was like, you know, the police academy yeah. voice. And I was like, I go, "For the amount of money Snickers is paying, I will fuck a Snickers bar on camera." and so we shot the commercial and I was about 40 pounds heavier, 50 pounds heavier. And I was wearing a unitard underneath my costume because they had me on a harness and they didn't want my nipples, I guess, to get worn down. And he raps early, but he sticks his head in my trailer and says goodnight. And I get a call the next day and he's like, "Why were you wearing a fat suit?" And I was like, I wasn't wearing a fat suit. And then he goes, "Rebecca, you're right." He had like a bet going, you know. And I remember when we were in the Caribbean and we were snorkeling, and this barracuda came up and it was just face to face with us. Suddenly, just swims right up, and I'd love to tell him a better man, but I just grabbed him and put him between me and the barracuda. Some instinct shit kicked in. And we started laughing and screaming and underwater. We actually ran out of the water with our fins. They should have played Benny Hill or something. But and he's like, "You just did that. That wasn't for comedy." I go, "Yeah, fuck you. You've had a good run. You know, yeah, you've had a good career. You know, it'll be Robin Williams and other attacked by barracuda. That's how that story goes. So
no, it would just be Robin Williams attacked.
Yeah, Robin Williams attacked. Yeah, because I would have lived. I go, I did my best. I fought valiantly against the barracuda, but
Robin Williams attacked her. And Robin Williams attacked near sentient fish bait. Yeah. Oh, come on. Yeah. I can't even.
Here's old chum cat Goldthwait. So, yeah. So today was it was a hard day, you know. But you know, and it was weird too because I've been promoting this movie, and he did have a little bit to do with it because the movie's Call Me Lucky, and it's a documentary about my friend Barry Crimmins, who is a political satirist. You know, the folks aren't aware of him too much, but he started the comedy scene in Boston, where people like Stephen Wright and Paula Poundstone and myself and all these folks came out of. But my favorite Barry Crimmins joke, because he was, like I said, he's a political satirist, was people say, if you don't love this country, why don't you leave it? He said, because I don't want to be victimized by its foreign policies. So a sharp guy. Plus, he's doing this, you know, in Boston, where it's like, you know, tell a fucking joke, you know. So, so Barry, as an adult, was processing his childhood rapes when he was a kid. No way, it gets funnier. And then Barry would be fine with that. We're, you know, so over it, you know. It was like the end of, did you ever see The Candidate, the Robert Redford movie?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we're just in the, just punchy. So he went online, AOL, he was looking for other survivors, and he finds all these guys exchanging child pornography in chat rooms when it's dial-up. So AOL's making money. He complains to AOL. They don't do anything. He goes to the police. We do. Boy, I'm really... He goes to the police. In the movie, the cops say, look, we didn't even have computers then. So Barry posed as a kid. Well, he didn't even have to pose. He just signed on as kids. Got all this evidence against these guys. What's not in the movie is that there was definitely arrests made by the feds, but the feds wouldn't be in the movie. I don't know why, seeing that the movie's about a leftist radical comedian. But but he did influence the Cleveland, the way the police do their procedures, and been responsible for other arrests. But so Barry took AOL to the floor of the Senate and kind of embarrassed them in a judiciary hearing. So it was a real Frank Capra story, and I wanted to make that as a movie. He was this, you know, little guy, you know, to go up against this giant corporation, and he embarrasses them, and he made changes, and I saw the rage in Barry shift, and he changed as a human, and he helps people, and he goes on with his life. So that getting that movie going, you know, I wanted to make it with an actor playing Barry. Probably I was thinking Robin, or actually he and I discussed a little bit, but that never was going to happen. I kept trying scripts. Barry tried scripts. So for 20 years I've been thinking about this movie. So Robin actually, 2014 in February, he was like, you know, you should make it as a doc. And I was like, all right. So I go, I don't have any money. He goes, I'll give you some money. You can start. So he gave me the money that started Call Me Lucky, and that's how the movie got made, you know? And then it premiered in the same theater. World's Greatest Dad premiered at Sundance. And it was weird because I wouldn't let Barry or Robin see those movies before they saw them. So Robin's sitting there next to me, and it was like the scene in Cape Fear where De Niro's Max Cady is sitting there laughing at Problem Child. Robin's like, because I've been to a lot of premieres with him where Robin would be squirming, you know? Some of his movies were what they were, and... But he laughed like a maniac at it. And Barry watched Call Me Lucky, and he's like, ugh, ugh, for the first 45 minutes. And I finally go, don't worry, I make you Jesus at the end.
So. Well, I think it's. I mean, you said you've lost other people, and I'm sure you know the process. But I think it's good to talk about it. I mean, I think it's one of those things where, if you feel it, just feel it. You know, like if you feel it, if you want to talk about it, if you want to laugh about it, if you want to cry about it, if you want to tell stories, and like I feel like you should. And yeah. And the people that we love and remember, kind of, I feel like they deserve that. They deserve you to feel it. So, you know, when people, you know, when people experience loss and they just start getting super fucked up or tickets, like, ah, you know, that person, you should try to feel this if you can for
but
them.
But it was hard for me to talk about it at first because it was so unique, because everybody feels this weird connection to him. So
unlike anyone, and I mean, like his death in particular sent so many ripples through the entire right. world, because I think people just assume, like, oh, he's a god, he's immortal, he's always going to be there.
Right.
Like,
maybe that was it.
He's everyone's favorite. He's like your uncle.
It was like Mickey Mouse died, you know?
Yeah.
So in a weird way, I have close friends and people, but it is weird when strangers will, this one guy was just so upset, you know, and he's like, you don't get it, you know, Mrs. Doubtfire is my favorite movie. And I was like, I'm sorry for your loss. it was just like, stop it. Yeah.
Well, you can still watch Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah, exactly. I can't call him, you know. He was my best pal, and I miss him. I miss him every day. But, you know, it's funny. I don't know why I was thinking of this, but we were walking along here, you know, and I used to direct the Kimmel Show, and I did that for 3 years. And did I ever tell you any of the Super Dave stories?
No, I think so.
Oh, so Super Dave used to be on the show.
Super Dave Osborne.
Yeah.
Not another Super Dave. Yeah. What am I saying? What?
Osborne.
Dave Einstein.
Dave Einstein.
Which Albert Brooks' brother.
That's right.
And he's always he's a funny guy, sharp guy, kind of, you know, but he would like to give it, you know, he likes to dish it out. So he comes on the show to pre-tape a bit, and I was like, who was on the show last night? Because you do so many shows, and it was like, Andy Dick, you know what that's like. Yeah. You're like, you're trying to remember, you don't remember, you finish the show. And so I go, I tell props to go get a television in a box, unwrap, and then gift wrap it. So they do this, and then I unwrap it halfway, and I write a card that says, Dear Andy, another amazing appearance, love the Jimmy Kimmel Show. And I go, now put this in Super Dave's dressing room, but don't put it in the corner. He was in there for 2 minutes. He's like, who the fuck is Andy? Who the fuck is Andy? How many times have I done this show? I've never got a fucking thing. You gave Andy Dick? He was like obsessed. Quick, tell me one thing funny Andy Dick's ever fucking done. Like, he's just furious. So they go, he's really pissed. I go, okay. So I go, well, move him out of that dressing room. And we had this other dressing room that used to be an actual closet that we... And so they put him in the closet, and then I had him wrap up a baseball cap, a Jimmy Kimmel Live baseball cap, and I wrote a note that says, Dear guest, thanks for coming on the show. furious. That I would just torture that man. I did, he has the Super Dave double, this mannequin that... Not a mannequin, you know, a dummy that's the thing that's getting crushed. But it spent thousands of dollars on it. And he was really, I'm going to leave it here, but I want it under lock and key. And so I hear about this. I'm like, great. So Jimmy's cousin Sal and myself get the dummy. And we just did photos of it. Just, you know, me fucking it on Jimmy's desk, you know, the dummy's nose in my asshole, you know. And then I blew up all these photos. Giant printer, so it was like 3x4 photos of me abusing his doll. Again, pissed, really pissed. And so I used to have a lot of fun while directing Kimmel.
I loved working with you. We did a pilot together a few years ago, and it was great because you wore this ridiculous hat on tape day. And you were like, yeah, if I'm wearing a ridiculous hat, then, you know, I can't really get too mad in the control room if anything goes wrong, because who's going to take you seriously if you're wearing a stupid fucking hat?
Let's remember who's got the fez on. it was from Kimmel. It's like, if you're screaming at people in a sombrero, you're a douchebag. So I tend to always wear a really dumb hat while I'm directing. And it really helped me, you know. And one day I was mad at Kimmel, and I come stomping down to the set. Gung, gung, gung. And the band director, Clito, goes, he's mad. He doesn't have a hat.
You left the hat.
Yeah, I actually threw the hat. But for the most part, I'd be pretty chill. I remember, did I tell you the Motley Crue story when they were on? Oh, so I'm sorry, I'm just babbling.
Please babble.
So I'm not sure they were doing this outdoor concert. And the manager comes in. For some reason, Nikki Sixx isn't at the dress rehearsal. I don't know if he left. I don't know what it is. And he goes, he's on the phone. He goes, Nikki, I'm going to put you on the phone with the director, Bobcat Goldthwait. No, yeah. No, the same guy. No, man, I'm serious. And so he goes, it's Nikki. And he hands me the phone. And I go, hey, man, what's going on? He goes, you know, the crew, we don't do many shows, and it's just none of this seems special. And I was like, well, you know, I really need you at rehearsal. I was going to have you come through the elephant doors, which we never have guests, and you guys are going to come there, and it was going to be backlit and smoke, and Wagner was going to be playing. He's like, Wagner? I go, you know, Apocalypse Now, da-da-da-da. And he's like, yeah, you know, right on, you know. So he turns around and comes to the rehearsal, and I hand the phone back to the manager. He goes, well, why didn't you tell me any of that stuff? I go, because I just came up with it. I really was like trying to think, what would a metal guy love?
You were writing the hackiest metal character.
Yeah. I was like, yeah, and Wagner, and yeah, so yeah.
And they played?
Yeah, they did. And you know, I was always concerned about people, and you know. Like, Mick Mars is, you know, and, like, I wouldn't be, I'd pull back and be a little kind to the camera and things like that, you know. Sometimes I don't want to tell the story, but it's because it was about an artist that didn't do well. And what I did was I acted like we had a technical fuck-up in the booth, so had him stay after and had him re-record it without a live audience.
Well, that's a nice thing to do.
Yeah. I guess I don't want to look good. No, I didn't want to out the artist. That's why.
Well, no, but I mean, it's a nice thing to do. That I feel like, and I think it's one of the benefits of someone who was a performer that then becomes a director is that you.
Oh yeah,
it's having the mentality of knowing like, oh well, we want this performer, because I think most directors, particularly in a situation like that where you're in a volume game of, look, we do five of these a week.
Yeah.
Let's get out of here, get the crew. But just to say, like, hey, we want to make sure you look really good.
Or you want to wrap your brain around the music and who they are and try to portray them in a way that they're not cringing when they watch it later on. But the direct opposite would happen when Nickelback was on. And they might be nice fellas, but they had a manager. Or I don't know who this guy is. He came into the booth. He goes, who's the director? And I go, I am. And he's like, well, don't shoot Chad profile. Only shoot him straight on. I'm like, well, who's Chad? He's like, he's our lead singer. And I've told this story on stage, but it's true. And I'm laughing. I go, why can't I shoot him, you know, from the side? He goes, because he's got a big nose. And I go, okay. And the cameraman can hear this conversation, and they're going, hey, pussy, are you really good, pussy? So they're
in your ear?
Yeah. While this guy's talking to me. and they're going, oh, they were really, it was pretty funny. They were pounding me. You go, oh, that what happened to the Bobcat we thought we knew. So as the show's going off the air, the band will play a second song. And I said to the assistant director, I go, tell me when I have 10 seconds left. She goes, okay. She goes, 10 seconds. I go, shoot the nose. And five of the cameras out of the seven, snap zoom in on this guy's nose. So I make a nose montage. Camera 3, camera 4, camera 1, camera 6, camera 2. We go off the air, dead quiet in the headset. And the actual conversation was, it was really quiet. And one of the guys go, hey, we were supposed to do that, right? Like, everybody's all like they're all weirded out. And they go, what are we doing now? I go, I'm getting in the car, man. So what happened was it made it to the East Coast, and somebody flipped out, and so the wide camera, so that's how they just, that couldn't zoom in, so they just tack that on for the rest of the broadcast.
That's why Kimmel will never get Nickelback back
yeah,
on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's always my, like, yesterday I did Larry King, and I was hoping, oh God, I hope he doesn't remember this. He was on, and part of the deal with him appearing was that his wife, who's this, you know,
an age-appropriate woman for me, not for Larry. and she's singing, you know, rock, blues, you know, whatever. But Larry's turned around with his face looking at her, just transfixed. And I put Larry's face in a heart. And then I had and I had it floating. I had it floating around her head as she was singing. It was just like... it was funny because I didn't know if this stuff would, you know, sometimes Jimmy would be like, oh, that was great. And then other times it's like, dude, you know, that, you know, now we can't get on X, Y, and Z. But he loved that kind of stuff. He, you know.
Did he remember? Did you bring it up?
No, I did not bring it up. I didn't intentionally, I didn't mention Kimmel because I don't know if that, how that went down. But Jimmy's cousin Sal was really funny. And we used to do this bit where it was a, they would do a celebrity in a box. So there would be a celebrity inside a box on Hollywood Boulevard. And you would grab people and you'd say, so you have three guesses. Who do you think the celebrity is? And Sal did not like doing the bit. And it was a runner and come through the show. And I didn't like it because it was complicated. And I just didn't like doing the bit. And I was like, Sal, you got to kill this bit. And he goes, okay. So the fix is in. So we cut to the first bumper. And... Jimmy goes, Sal, and he's got a someone who's going to play the game. Sal, and Jimmy goes, Sal, who do you got with you? And he goes, it's Barry Williams. Oh, you mean this person? I thought you meant in the box. And I go, hit the confetti. It goes, poof. And then the box opens up. And it's like the band plays a sting. And it comes back to Jimmy, who's both furious and in love, you know, with Sal. So it was pretty cool.
Well, I mean, Jimmy, as much as Jimmy likes to fuck with people,
yeah.
He loves to mercilessly fuck with, in a fun way.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I mean, he's a great.
Yeah. So it was I loved that show. It was really fun to have a job. You know, I started doing stand up when I was 16 and I got on Letterman when I was 20. So outside being a janitor in my high school, and I'd never had a job where I showed up every day. So Kimmel was great for 3 years. I got to meet people and talk to them about their family and have a weekend off. It was pretty cool.
And you're still touring now.
I do stand-up, but I direct on a lot of people's TV shows, a lot of comedians, and then I make a movie about every year and a half.
Why is it feels like stand-up is particularly difficult to shoot. Because, and I assume it's because, well, you know, stand-up really is a live experience. It's a very communal experience. And if you're not in that immediate group, if you're not there seeing it live, you sort of miss out on the energy. And so it tends to be more about the jokes and how it's shot when you're shooting, as opposed to, you know, getting swept up in the energy of being in a live room. So how do you?
Well, I always think that that when I'm directing a stand-up special, the thing is that I should make the audience feel like they had the best seat in the house, you know, and not be cutting to the back of the theater. Like, that's annoying to me. It's like, what would it look like if I had really shitty seats in the middle of a joke? I just did Barons, and I think finally stumbled on something that I thought really worked. I was thinking about when we make movies, you know, you can have focus, like close-ups, but on comedy shows you don't. So I actually had a long lens with two operators, so someone was pulling focus just like we were shooting a movie, and I shot a profile, and I really like it because Maron's not all over the stage, and you kind of feel like you're in his head. You know, he's, even though he's in front of a 1,500 people, he's crouched in a ball on the stool, and I was really happy the way it came out.
Will you please put in a thing in his special where you put my head in a heart and just bounce it around?
It could be my head in a guillotine. He's Mark. Boy, no. You do a spot-on impression of him.
I do?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I guess. But I don't ever – I'm never conscious of it. It's just when I'm repeating stuff I think he would say.
You were doing an impression of his cats.
Oh, I was?
Yeah,
When was I doing that?
When we were doing that TV show. I don't know if it was on the air.
Oh, wow. I totally forgot. I guess – because we're totally fine now, but there was a period where he's like, yeah, I see you doing stand-up up there. It's good to see you try real hard. Like, it's just like, okay. All I said was hello, you know?
Well, yeah, and it's you know, his mark, you know. And if you're not having if you didn't have a beef with him, then you wouldn't be his friend in a weird way. Like sometimes I'm like, oh man, we haven't had a beef. I don't think Mark likes me.
I felt that. Like we never had any kind of static between us. And I was like, maybe that means we're not friends. Like,
No. I don't think it means that. And he's, you know, he's not that way. And it's not that way anymore.
But I you know, and now it sounds like I'm backpedaling, but I'm a big fan. I mean, I love his interviews and I work on his TV show. But you know, we're friends. We work together. We drive each other nuts. That's how it goes.
Yeah. When's the special? When's that coming out?
I think that comes out in December.
Cool.
Yeah. So and I did Patton's special and Brian Posehn with Jonah tell you?
Yes, Jonah and Brian both told me, we haven't talked about it publicly because we don't want to give away the thing. But
it's one of those, it's really weird. It's truly weird.
It's a really weird thing and it's not even in the end.
And I don't even want to, it's not like Bobcat Goldthwait said something's weird. It's got to be weird. No. It's fucked up. And it happens in the
middle. You didn't have to fucking do it.
I know, but it happened in the middle of the show.
Yeah.
And it was so weird.
I was like, did you close that? No, we did it in the middle of the show. No.
And it's so beautiful. And the crowd's laughing at first, and then they're getting really mad. It was beautiful.
The first crowd. You didn't have to make eye contact with any of those people.
Oh, it was so great. And what made me happy was how mad people were getting. Like happy, you know. That was my old early stand-up. It wasn't like, you know, it was always about, you know, making people laugh is one thing, but like if afterwards they were like, did you see what he did, you know, that used to make me really happy. You know, I would just go on stage when I first started doing stand-up, and I would start a stand-up comedy app, then I'd stop and I would pull out a Dear John letter and read it, and then I'd start crying. And then I'd go back to the stand-up, and I'd go, my wife is so fat. How fat is she? And I go, I told you I don't even have a girlfriend, you know. And it would just be, and I'd try to do observational humor while I was, you know, real tears. Or gut fish on stage. You know, because people didn't like they couldn't wrap their brain around the character that I was doing because it was so extreme. And I knew that there was a vibe from a lot of the comics. You know, just do it as a character, then do other stuff. So I came out of character. I go, oh, hi, this is my real voice. And the crowd's like, oh, and this is the part of the show where I like to gut and clean a fish. And does anyone have a fish? And my roommate had this huge long herring that was rancid because it had been in the trunk of the car. And
what the fuck?
And so I take this fish and I just slit its guts open on stage. And this woman in the front row just immediately, because it was rancid, just projectile vomited. and so I put the mic down so you could hear her vomiting over the thing. So there's fish entrails and vomit.
A complete and utter barf-o-rama.
And then I'm like, well, thank you. You've been a great crowd. You know, and the next guy, who's a very funny comedian, Bill Campbell, but, you know, very traditional stand-up, comes out, and he's like, you know, relationships are weird. And there's guts all over. And the guy who owned the club was Shun Lee. It was the Ding Ho. And I had very few conversations with Shun Lee, and that night I had one. They said, Shun wants to talk to you. And I go back, and he goes, Bobby, you're weird. You're too weird. You're weird. Like, if you called the Ding Ho, it was like, who's on first? You'd go, hey, this, because you would... You'd call there to get picked up to go drive to Rhode Island or something. And you'd be like, hey, this is Bobcat Goldthwait. And Bobcat, no, here. He, no, here. No, this is Bobcat. It was like this Asian who's on first that would go on.
I just can't believe that no one, like, who cleaned up the fish?
That's a good question. I don't remember me cleaning it up. But it didn't matter. The Ding Ho was like, Barry ran the club. And it was anarchy. I mean, it really was. Like, we would lock the doors and windows and put cardboard over them so daylight didn't come in because we'd party all night. And I don't talk about that much, but, you know, I've been sober since I was 19. But I got sober because of the life I was leading going to the Ding Ho. And I remember I remember just doing blow on the bar. And the door opens up, and these cops come in, and they're backlit. It was very cinematic, and and I'm gacked out of my mind, and I'm 19, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to jail. And the cops go, Lenny, how the fuck are you? And they come in, and they sit down, and they start doing blow at the bar. And I was just like, you know, up is down, you know? So it was really crazy. This is a story that, you know, Barry doesn't like it when I tell the story, but there was a... I stopped drinking, and this other comedian was in kind of a blackout and at the Dingho, and he had me in a headlock, and he's trying to pour liquor down my throat.
Oh, Jesus.
And Barry had broken his wrist. He had a cast on because he punched a wall. In his defense, the wall made the first move, but he had this cast on. And so the guy who's got me in the headlock goes, hug me. He goes, Barry's like, let him go. And he's like, hug me or hit me, Mr. Crimmins. And Barry goes, it's the fastest decision I ever made in my life. And he pops him in the jaw with his cast.
Oh, shit.
And he breaks his jaw. And let me, and I got freed. And then, but then the next day they hugged it out. And the guy was did song parody. So the next day he's got his mouth wired shut while he's singing song parodies. So that was the Dingho. It was bedlam. It was chaos. It was, but all these comics came out with all these different unique takes. You know?
And so that, in your mind, what was it that you were doing on stage back then? Was it, oh, they're going to think it's funny if I'm gutting a fish, or like, oh, I just want to do something different, or I wasn't trying
to stand out. It was, as a little boy, I was such a stand-up comedian fan. I was a fanatic when I was a tiny kid. That by the time I was 16, traditional stand-up comedy didn't really mean much to me. I really loved Andy Kaufman and Brother Theodore and people like that. So I was definitely, my early stand-up was just almost performance art. You know, that sounds pretentious, but that's really what I was about.
So the guy, the character,
yeah,
that guy, it's interesting that you were sober for all, pretty much.
Yeah,
all of
people
that.
Always think I was messed up because I set the Tonight Show on fire. You know, they go, "Oh, well, you must be high."
Oh yeah, you set the couch on fire.
Yeah. The chair I'd been sitting in. I act like that's a normal thing. You know, my daughter grew up and you know, I got arrested. Well, I didn't get arrested. I got arrested for the Tonight Show, but the Arsenio Hall show, I had smashed up, caused way more damage than that Tonight Show chair. I got charged $700 for that chair. But at Arsenio Hall, I had smashed up the whole set. I had spray painted Paramount Sucks on the backdrop because he was getting fired. And then I put my Doc Martens to this like $3,000 monitor. And, you know, I just smashed the whole show up. It was funny. And, the producer's like, get him. And so Arsenio tackles me, and I'm rolling around on the ground, and he whispers in my ear, thank you. So my daughter and I are coloring, and she was about 8, and she grew up with Lily Idol, Eric Idol, and Tanya Idol's daughter as her best friend, you know. And the news comes on, and it goes, comedian goes berserk on the Arsenio Hall show, and I'm coloring with Tasha, and she looks up, and she's like, ugh. I go, what? She goes, sometimes you act like you don't have a brain in your head. Oh, and I go, well, it's just comedy. She goes, it's not comedy. It's on the news. Lily's dad's never on the news.
Oh, did that make you a python? Yeah.
Yeah, he did sketch stuff. It's completely different.
He doesn't go on as a kid.
He'd be a character.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we could talk all about why I was doing that kind of stuff, but basically, I think I was just had painted myself in a corner and just was so unhappy, you know. I was being more famous before I started doing that kind of stuff. I felt like Richard Simmons. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'd go on a talk show, I'd do this persona, and it would go over really well. But I wasn't doing anything else, you know, and I can't really blame now. I can't blame showbiz. I wasn't doing the things that make me happy, you know. Now I love what I do.
Well, I think it's hard not to, when something starts working.
Yeah,
you just start doing it, and then I think by the time you realize what happened, it was almost you were so far down that road.
It was horrible. Yeah,
and then that's why I never like being in character for things. It's like, but then. Then you might be stuck in that.
Yeah.
And if you start hating that guy,
yeah.
But then you got to come out and do the hey, remember, you
yeah.
know?
Like, oh yeah, and then my working class upbringing would kick in. Like, you know, I'm at the Nashville Funny Bone and people are zany, sorry, and people are there to see this persona that I have nothing in common with anymore, and I feel, well, I have to do it because these that's what the people paid money to see. So I became, you know, trapped because I felt an obligation. But I mentioned that club because that's where it ended. Like, one day I just said, I can't do this. Like, I thought I hated stand-up. It's like, no, I hate this fucking character. And I went on for the first time, like, you know, as me. And they were and there was people yelling, you know, do the voice. You know, they still yell that when I'm in the Heartland.
Tell about the Colorado story.
Oh, well, that one. That was a police academy. And this person's pretty relentless. And the woman, it was this woman, and she was in the back of the room. And she said, I'm from Aurora. And I go, I know, you've learned to sit in the back.
Oh, shit.
I'm not proud of these skills.
I fucking love that joke so much.
Yeah, there's sometimes it's like halfway out and I'm like, oh.
I like how you describe the audience reaction where people like acted like they just didn't hear that.
Yeah, yeah. Like, well, that didn't happen. Because I really like this guy.
As if we had to acknowledge that.
Yeah, yeah. I like this guy, and that's
him.
Terrible. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, it was like I was doing a show, and these women were really. I'm not proud that I can shut hecklers up. It's just a skill that, you know, that's not good to have. Basically, you know. So these women just won't shut up, and the crowd's telling them to shut up, and they're just drunk. And then finally I snap, and I unload on this table of women, and I stop because I can hear the, like, I really kind of, like, you know, I stop, and I can hear the crowd cheering, and then I go back into my nightclub act, and about 5 minutes later, one of the women stands up, and she's sobbing, and she's, I'm not a whore. It's my birthday. So apparently at some point I called her a whore.
Oh, no.
So then her and the table and then their fellas are all leaving the club, and they're still giving me shit as they're going out the door. And just as I'm seeing her almost out the door, I go, happy birthday in the whole club, because everybody's evil all saying happy birthday.
Oh, no. Well, I do think that skill set, I mean, I think it is helpful to have that defense mechanism, especially if you're not someone that can punch people in the face.
Right.
You got to have something, you know, like you have to have.
But it's ideally it would be just not having to do that part of the show. I mean, yeah, but sometimes you have to, and that, I guess if every time there were great crowds and there weren't hecklers, it would be boring, maybe? I don't know. Do you believe that?
Well, it definitely, I think the important thing that it does is that it forces you to stop and be present. You have to be present you're being heckled, because you can't be on autopilot. You have to deal with the situation, and I'd spend a lot of time talking to the crowd in my act anyway, so it doesn't. So for me, if someone does that, it's not super like, oh, I have to stop the. You know, it's right. Just like, oh, well, this is just part of the conversation. That person's being a shithead. I can sort of deal with them. But it does. There are parts of it that kind of make you feel alive. And I'm not trying to encourage people to heckle comedians more, but
if you want to help the show, yes, please.
But you know, but sometimes do you find it's actually hard to follow up dealing with a heckler with your act, because it's so much part of the shared experience? Then you step back out of it. It's like, here's a thing that doesn't involve you guys.
Because it's live, you know. So in those situations, when I'm working back into my material, I try to jumble it up.
Yeah,
and try to make it more conversational, or tie it into what happened, or just But I, how often are you doing dates?
I think I'll have done by the end of the year about 50 road dates.
And do you ever get hecklers that are too drunk that they're screwing up the show and they don't know it?
Not so much anymore. Although there was a guy in Chicago that. I came out and I opened the set talking about my dad dying, but not in a dramatic way. And it's actually I just kind of started playing around in those waters, and it was going really well. Like, I would be the first to tell you if the show wasn't going well. It was going really well, and then some guy in the balcony, and these people came to see me on purpose. Some guy in the balcony was like, "You suck. The other guy was funnier," referring to Mike Lawrence, who opened for me, who is astonishingly hilarious. And so it actually threw me off, because I was like, well, I wasn't bombing, and I was also it was like there was a confluence of things that confused me. It's like, you clearly bought a ticket to see me, but you've just heckled me like you've never heard. Like, no. Why are you here? This is a theater. Why are you here? And then I was also talking about my dead dad. And it was like, just all these things. My immediate response was like, you could fucking leave. Like, it was like, no one's forcing you to stay here. Yeah. You know, like, it was such a strange – I didn't handle it as well as I normally do, because so many things about it completely confused me, because I way would have expected it if I had just been in a random club somewhere.
Yeah, a nightclub.
It was just a nightclub. Like, you know, no one knew who I was. And it's like, you know, I would expect that. But it threw me off because of the context of it.
How do you even engage a heckler when he's on a balcony, like way in the back?
And sounded pretty drunk. And so it just sort of seemed like, all right, well, he's drunk and he just fucking, like, he didn't immediately recognize any of the reference points, and so something.
Yeah. I did a show, like, it was probably 80s or 90s. There was a hurricane in Miami, maybe, and we're playing a stadium, and the show was like the Bee Gees, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Gloria Estefan, Whoopi Goldberg, probably Robin. I mean, just the list went on and on, and the show it was sponsored by Bacardi. So it starts at 5, and I go on at 2 a.m. I go on as the last act as they're bringing everyone else up. And I go out, and I go, hey, I don't want to be rude, but did this place used to have a roof? You know, because it's a hurricane, it's a stadium. And then I see the furthest guy I can actually make out, and I'm like, you, under the Uniroyal sign, under the tire, third row, and I had the audience actually pick the guy. Like, they figured it out. They're waving. And single is one guy. I go, yeah. What do you do for a living? I started doing crowd work in a football stadium. Yes.
That's too many people for comedy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Please welcome...
You can't.
It was even weirder than that, because I've become friends with Andy Garcia, but he was like, he was hosting it. My daughters were friends also, and they grew up together and went to the same school, but I had just met him, I think, for the first time, and he was, and then at this thing, he's introducing me, he goes, your kids go to the same school, and he may have had a Bacardi or two, and I go, I know you're always so well-dressed, you know, and I show up, because he would always be in a suit at school picking up the kids, and I go, and I show up, and they think I'm going to steal children. And so he goes out there, like I said, he may have been inviting. He goes, this next guy, he wants to steal kids. No. something like that.
Similar to that. A few
because
words.
He goes to school. He wants to steal kids. Please welcome.
Hi, everyone. Gonna steal your kids.
Oh, my God.
I think it's the weird thing about a crowd like that size is that they can they rarely will come together as a group.
Yeah, yeah,
so you
yeah.
might get one section, yeah. but then the loge is kind of their yeah. own faction, and it's sort of
You must get that when you're playing theaters. Like wow, this is really playing on one side of the theater.
Well, the theaters are good. I think when you get to 3,000 and above, it's probably that way. Right. These are like. The biggest one's probably about 1,800,
okay.
which is actually still the theater's shallow. Like, they're not super deep when they're shallow and there's balconies, and it still feels like one room. But I think when you get above a couple thousand people, that's when they start, especially in rooms that are where the audience goes way back from the stage, and you start giving them distance, and then that's when they're feeling disconnected.
It was a few years back was my birthday. And my other dear friend, Tony V, was playing the Riviera in Vegas, and Robin was playing the MGM, and like where they have like MMA, you know?
Right.
And so I hadn't done stand-up in about 5 years because I've been directing stuff, and Tony's on stage, and there's like 20 people there, and I go, bring me up. And he's like, really? I go, yeah, bring me up. So I jump on stage and I start doing stand up. My daughter was there and she's like, do the voice. She really was. Such a fucking ball buster. Bobcat. That's how she, I go, what? She goes, do the voice. Like, just a terrible person. So I hear Robin, he's like, bring me up. And I was like, really? So yeah, Robin and myself, and we just did donuts. We just goofed around. We had one of my favorite times on stage, you know. And then it was funny because then the next night, Robin's at the MGM, and he did well, and the crowd liked him. He had fun, but I knew he had way more fun when we were just fucking off.
Yeah, because when you can tell that the crowd's engaged, and you can, I mean, like, I would imagine by the time you're doing the MGM Grand at that point, it's just sort of like, it's almost kind of like watching a movie, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you can't, because he's something.
I remember watching the screen more than him.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and Tony V, I don't know if you know, he's a big comedian, he's a really sweet guy, but he's a large guy, Tony, tough-looking guy, but a sweetheart from Boston, and this is not that long ago, and people were coming up to the table, we're gambling, all of us were playing blackjack, and this guy goes, hey, Mork, where's Mindy? Oh. And Tony goes, she's over there sitting at fuck off and asked you to join her. and Robin would never say anything like that. I said, oh, you know, but he's totally fucking loving it though at the same time. But yeah.
Everyone, I think most people, if you've been in the business for any length of time and had any amount of success, everyone's got a Where's Your Mindy, Do the Voice. Like,
yeah.
Everyone's kind of got those.
What's yours? Is it the.
Did you fuck Jenny McCarthy?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's.
Yeah.
And then the future will be points.
Yeah. It's still kind of that now.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm fine. You know, it doesn't really. I think it depends on.
Well, you know what the problem is?
The aggression.
There's no answer to that. Like,
right.
It's just like, you know, first of all, I'm not going to talk to you about women if it was true. You know, I mean, just, there's no, how do I get off this?
Yeah, I think it's only when it's contextualized, when someone says it aggressively, right. Hey, and you're like, are we supposed to fight? Like, I don't understand.
No.
Like, some people just want you to know, like, I know who you are. And you're not better than me. I was like, yeah. I don't think I was. I'm not. Yeah. I get a lot of times when people,
it's usually women, is like, my friends say you're important. I don't know who you are. It's like, yeah, I'm important. I'm at the same Dave and Buster's you are. Right? I'm super important. Well, you should know. I was in Hot to Trot, miss. You know. You don't want to give up on people.
Hey, did you fuck Dabney Coleman?
Hey, did you fuck that horse?
Did you fuck the horse? Did you fuck that horse?
That horse hated me. I remember telling they would hit it in the face with a stick to make its mouth move.
No, that's so sad.
Yeah, so it's already a horrible experience making the movie. And Robin's like, so how's it going? I go, it'd be like doing Mork and Mindy, and when they yell action, someone punched Pam Dauber in the mouth. That's how much
that's
fun
horrible.
This is. It's the worst thing ever. So this horse would see me and know that he's going to get hit.
No.
So it hated me because it's an animal. It's smart. So it hated me. It'd step on me. It'd put its foot on me, you know. And
getting your camera shot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't block the money. But he there's this old guy, Corky, and he would sit there on an apple box all day and with a shovel, and a horse will raise its tail before it craps. And this guy was like a ninja. That tail would go up, and that shit never hit the floor. He would have that shovel under its ass and catch it. It was,
wow.
It was impressive. So I see the tail going up. I look over at Corky, and he's just sitting on his apple box, not getting up. And then the horse shat. It had diarrhea, and it looked like spin art. Everything 5 feet down, covered in spray, including me, just like a fire extinguisher, fire hose pressure, diarrhea, all over the set. I'm covered in shit. And the first AD goes, that's a wrap, ladies and gentlemen.
It's like Corky knew what kind of shit was going to come out, so he knew not to fucking approach.
Corky knew that he'd been, that the horse had died.
See, this is the kind of things where...
That's the inside.
It's unfortunate that you couldn't tell stories like that for the DVD extras.
Or for the press junket, because that's what would happen. I would be on junkets and I'd start telling stories people get really mad. Like they would get really mad being honest at a press junket.
You're not supposed to do that, especially for supposed to be like a family movie.
But somebody just did it, goofing around. I think Paul Rudd maybe with Ant-Man. Like he was just making a joke or two, and people were like, they just, Ant-Man's real. They were really hurt.
Well, I think. For people who are accustomed to dealing with horrible things with humor in certain contexts, that people don't always know how to deal with it. So they from the person's point of view who is like, I'm just fucking around and it's because I'm tired and I'm just trying to, this is a weird situation and this is my armor. This is my defense mechanism. This is how I.
Well, I think when you're. The generation now, if you make fun of yourself, I don't think they can process that. Like if you do self-effacing humor, if I do self-effacing humor on Instagram, people go, "Oh, come on, man!" It's like it's using a little irony, and sarcasm. Because I feel like there's a generation of entertainers that just say, I'm the greatest. Like, it's just made us all wrestlers, you know?
Yeah.
I shouldn't even shit on wrestlers like that. I like wrestlers.
Well, I think certain, like, some comedy just wasn't meant for everybody.
Yeah.
And so...
That's
how
I feel about my movies. I make my movies so tiny and so far outside the system, and I'll read a bad review, and I'm like, yeah, okay. See you next year, bitch. You're not going to stop me. I just keep making them. I know. It's like, right on, But that's weird about, and now I am self-promoting, that people really like Call Me Lucky, and that's almost even hard for me to process. Success or to have people... like something is weird, but I can at least realize that people like it because it's Barry's story, and that the movie does speak on a bigger level, the about adult abuse, and so at these screenings, there's all these after the screenings, people will come up and they're crying, and they'll come up and they'll disclose, and sometimes for the first time they'll be disclosing about their own child abuse, and I've always been a bit of a misanthrope, but now. It's forced me to hug people and touch people, and it's fucking annoying. No, it's not, no. I'm only kidding about that, but it has forced me to be physical, which is really funny because I've always had a problem with that. But now I see, there's a big guy come lumbering up, and his eyes are all puffy, and I'm like, come in here, get a hug.
Get a piece.
Yeah. So,
well, that's nice. I mean, it's, when you start telling those kinds of stories, I mean, you really...
It's time for me to do a talking duck movie. This is too much fucking reality.
Is that the after show for Howard the Duck?
Anything, yeah. I mean, I think it's me trying to... I'm only half kidding, I'm going to do Quackers or something. After doing a talking horse movie that wasn't funny, I'm going to do an animal talking movie and prove them all wrong.
I think you could do a movie... I think you could do a movie about a movie that, like
Making Quackers.
The Making Quackers.
Well, I did the first short I ever did was The Making of Bikini School 3, and it's me, lampooning Making Police Academy, where the producer's like, I lose money in Canada. The Canadian crews are just technically more advanced. And then you see a director filming a scene where there's a bird crapping out a guy's head, and he's like, and poop. God, we're not gonna get one better than that. Let's not put our foot through a Van Gogh, people. So that was a. But I just keep making movies. I'm really happy. I've had some tragedy, but I think we all do. And everything shifted for me this year. Toby Huss and my friend John Wiener, we always go into the ocean at New Year's, and we run in there. It's not that cold. It's L.A., but sometimes it's 50. And we speak to the universe,
And they're, you know, I'm not that cosmic. I'm more of an agnostic. But they, you know, they'll run in the ocean and be like, this is the year I get paid to be creative. Or, this is the year I find the woman that's good for me and for, you know, who'll be my soulmate. And then it comes to me and I'm like, snow tires. I want snow tires. You know, I've always been a sarcastic prick. But this year, well, we're all yelling the things to the universe. I said, bring me more pain, you know? That's what I asked for. You know, who's this, you know, and it changed because my whole perception was like, when is this going to stop? This has been so relentless this year. And when I suddenly said, well, maybe it could be more. So once I thought of that, I actually did get a lot of relief. And today just kicked me in the ass. You know, today was just hard, you know? I didn't see it coming, that it would affect me that much. I don't talk about my friend. I think it's important for me to talk about him because sometimes I mention his involvement in getting the movie going and supporting it. But I also don't want to be someone that's promoting a movie on my friend's death, for God's sakes. That would be horrible. So it's been a weird junket, that's for sure.
Well, I appreciate that you came in anyway, and that you came and did At Midnight anyway, and you came here anyway.
I'll be interested. I actually don't watch myself. I may watch me at midnight because I was like really just checked out. Like I was just trying. I was like, say something, talk. Like if you notice, I never hit the fucking buzzer.
I saw you go for it and then pull back.
I don't know. I was just like so.
I think it's good, even if it helped. Well, you were really fucking funny, so it wasn't. Good. I mean, I don't think it was like, ugh.
I was once out of this Australian game show, and whenever the host wasn't looking, I'd slap the woman's buzzer that was sitting next to me, and he goes, Sophie. And she's like, he keeps hitting my buzzer. I go, look, you're going to lose. You know? You know, don't drag me into it.
I just think if anything, even if it kind of helped distract you for a little bit, because it makes me happy to see that your demeanor has changed a little bit from when you came in and you've actually started smiling and having fun and telling these stories. And I think it makes me happy that I think if this in any way kind of helped you get some of it out a little bit.
Yeah, and thank you. And it did. And it's nice to, you know, here's the thing that would be a real horrible thing if people forgot that Robin was a man.
Yeah.
You know, that he was a dude that, you know, that would be horrible. Sure, he was super talented. Sure, he was really generous and kind and fun and everything. But he's also a dude, you know? He's a man, you know? And that's the guy I miss, you know?
And the responsibility of someone who's so eager to entertain people.
Yeah, I would bust his balls, you know, because he would be on, you know? And whenever he got on, I would just kind of check out. And I was like, you know, it's important for you that everybody in this restaurant thinks you're funny. I go, they already love you, you know? This is crazy, you know? I go, and he's like, well, you want everybody to listen to you. And I go, yeah, I know, but your form of neuroses is way more lucrative. He goes, you piss people off. You want them to listen to you. He goes, it's the same thing. I go, yeah, I guess. Yeah.
But I think that's why it's easy for people to, you know, because you can take people for granted when you're like, oh, he seems always happy all the time.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, yeah.
Like, and what a responsibility for someone who constantly makes people feel better. They always just assume like, oh, well, he'll just make you feel better. Well, he's got, yeah, you know, he's got problems. And we're going, no, he's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
He's looking,
yeah,
all right. Look, he's fucking around. He's making the salt talk or whatever.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
No, he's really needs, like, he's a person. That
or just needs, you know, and he got sick, you know, and everybody's going to speculate and talk and gossip, but at least I weighed in with my two cents.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would want people to understand about besides that, you know?
Well, I mean, just don't go down that road and assume it was alcohol or drugs or depression. You know, he was, you know, his autopsy did come back with Lewy body dementia, which is a form of dementia. And I believe that that is really what took my friend, you know? So, and again, I'm not a doctor or anything, but that's just my take. And I got to say, it doesn't really concern me too much if the world's opinion changes on that. I just know that, and that's enough for me.
Well, that's the most important thing. I mean, he was your friend, and you had a personal connection to him and everyone else didn't. And of course the world is filled with, you know, the world is filled with uneducated experts.
Well,
you know,
now I'm gossiping, but one of his friends, dear friends, actually, he said, boy, you know, I never heard him say anything bad about anyone. And I started laughing because I thought he was making a joke. And then the other people were there and then it was pointed out to me. They go, well, you're the only one that he did talk smack around. I was like, oh, he hated a lot of people. Yeah. That's what made me laugh. I was like, oh, really? Oh, yeah. So I'm the keeper of the of the keys. Yeah.
I mean, is it? Did your brain go to inappropriate joke places to deal with it?
Oh, of course, you know, I'm coming off of a documentary that's about child abuse and the amount of dark humor from Barry and myself while we're making it. You know, he went into the basement where he was raped as a kid, and we actually had a huge argument. I'm like, you're not going in there. I was filming anyways because I wanted to film the space. I didn't want to do reenactments, and whenever I say that, he goes, you didn't want to do reenactments. But so he fights with me. He's like, I'm going in that basement. You know, you go through a problem, you're not around it. I'm not giving this building any magical powers. You can film it or not. I'm going in. I go, give me 5 minutes. So spin the cameras around. And I've known Barry most of my life. And he goes into shock, but he's very articulate and very well-spoken in the basement. It's eloquent what he says down there. And he says to me afterwards, he goes, because he was just in complete shock, you know, he's chipmunking a beer, as he likes to say. He drinks a beer with both hands like a chipmunk. But he says, I was really in shock. I don't know what I said there. Is any of it usable for the movie? And I said, oh, it doesn't matter. I'm going to play Yakety Sax the whole time you're in the basement.
But I feel like that, you know.
Oh, it's beyond needed, that kind
it
of.
It is needed to break the tension. And also, and I think that type of stuff, it's not about being disrespectful, because obviously you both know it's a horrible situation and we're all in a lot of horrible situations. I think it's about, it at least just it gives us a little bit of like power, even if it's like a fake power over it. I feel like it gives you this, I feel like that's why humor is important. It helps you like you have some control over an otherwise completely unpredictable, uncontrollable world.
You know, and when Robin passed away, people were all going, well, I knew him this long and I knew him that long. And Robin's son, Zach, came up with the term competitive grieving. And that killed me. Yeah. You know?
So you're better somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I've known him longer. Whatever.
He's still not alive. Like, why?
Yeah,
are you fucking...
you know, and that's the thing. You know, some people will start. They come up to me and they start going down this road about different things and gossip, and I'm like, and I have to cut them off. I go, my friend's still gone. You know, I don't have time for any of these conversations. You know,
I met him one time. It was at SF Sketchfest, and we were at the Mill Valley Theater, and it wasn't his show. He just showed up.
Yeah.
He didn't even ask to go on or anything. And he was just hanging backstage in the green room and just riffing with everyone. And the thing that was so amazing about him is that he didn't make everyone feel like I'm the star of the room.
No.
He was as generous with laughter and encouraging other people. And it just felt like, and it elevated everyone else in the room. Cause you're like, oh my God, I'm riffing with this guy. I'm riffing with Robin Williams. I don't know if he toned it down to help us feel like
as earthlings.
I don't know if he put on ankle weights or it made it like Celebrity Jeopardy. Yeah.
But it
made everyone feel like, oh, we're a part of the same thing.
And when I talk about his generosity, that's true. You know, it's like he made us laugh, but he would also laugh at what you had to say. He listened to what you had to say. He laughed, you know. When a few years back he was getting back to, and doing some stand up, and Caitlin, who's with me now, she lived in San Francisco. I was like, where's the alt rooms? Because I didn't want to take him to clubs that he had played 30 years ago where there might be people with resentments and known him for, you know, and all the young comedians were so excited to meet him, and they're all helping him and giving him tags and doing what you're saying. You know, we would sit there with a legal pad, and and that we would come up with a topic, and like if it was too dark, he'd be like, "Well, that's for your stack." Like, he'd be like, "That one's in your pile." You know, he'd be like, "It'd be pretty funny."
I wonder if he ever kind of envied the freedom that you have to, because it, like you just you really will say whatever you feel yeah. like on stage, and if you know whether or not. And I think that's really freeing to not have to worry about, is this going to affect something or right. are people going to – is my – you know, like you've always kind of pushed the envelope in that way, and so people know that's what you do.
Yeah, I mean he might have. But you know, and I would watch him and we would be working and I would see him building 40 minutes or getting an act together, and then I'd just see him some night just go pew. Like really down like a whole like, you know, just riff like 10, 20 minutes that was brand new that he hadn't done before. It was really freakish when that would happen. It was really cool. That was magic. That was rad. I finally told a story that people probably wanted to hear, that kind of stuff. But you know, the I tell that Shaggy Dog airplane story, which was true. And by the way, I don't have a bone to pick with the mentally challenged, but I started with the basketball story. But there was... it's a long story and it is true, but I was on a flight where Special Olympics people were on and the engine blew up, and it's a long story. It's in my act, you know, and I'll do a really quick version. But they're saying that we're going to, you know, when we land in Cleveland, the runway will be covered entirely in foam, and at the very end of the runway will be a fire truck. And then clear as a bell, I hear one guy in the back of the plane go, "Fire truck." You know, he was excited. He was going to see a fire truck. I say
everyone else thinks they're going to die.
Yeah, he's excited. Fire truck, you know, easy for you. You got a medal. So, I went from atheist to agnostic at that moment. Like, maybe there is a God, you know. And I would say, I go, look, I know some of you have mentally challenged people in your family, but or work with them. But if you don't think they say or do anything funny, you're denying that they're human beings, because that's the funniest fucking thing I've ever heard another human being say. So I was told that story. This woman stands up. And she's furious, and she's making a big deal out of it. It was even great. She starts stomping out of the room, and she goes to the door, and that door was locked, so she had to come back through the crowd, and she's stomping out. And I told that story early on. I was only into my act for like 5-10 minutes, and I go, "Is that lady gone?" Because her friend stayed. I go, "Is that lady gone? Is she gone? Is she out of the room?" They go, "Yeah." I go, "All right. Hey, He doesn't know he's doing this, but I'm going to please my friend's here because he's going to finish. Robin Williams, come on up here." So he came up and he did it like about 50 minutes to an hour.
Oh, wow.
And then I bring him off stage. I go, "All right, you're done." And I go to the table. I go, can you text those people text that woman right now and tell her what happened after I left?" "Oh, Robin Williams, Bobcat left. Robin Williams did. He did an hour." That's 100% true story. Yeah.
Well, I think you know, I don't know. I've known you for a bit, and I've always really loved hanging out with you. And I think he was really lucky to have you as a friend, like just as a dude who could, you know, because in his position, I'm sure a lot of people would be like, "Oh, Robin, whatever you want," you know. But to know that you actually were honest with him and you could fuck with him, and you know, I'm sure he really appreciated that. So I think, you know, as much of a good friend as he was to you, I would be willing to bet that, you know, he was really lucky to have you as a friend too.
Oh, thanks.
So, what do you guys want to go? What do you want to do now?
I'm gonna go do a set because I'm feeling super funny. I gotta get on stage.
You just feel the itch.
I didn't even bring up Roddy Piper.
Oh no!
Yeah, Roddy was my pal. I mean, he wasn't like Robin and I, but yeah, Roddy and I were pals. I'm like, "Oh my God, why did I say that in the ocean?
why did you use the universe to kill everyone you love?"
I know. But I'm well. But yeah, Roddy was just, you know, I loved Roddy. He was. You know, he was great, you know. I think, yeah, I loved Roddy. Did you ever meet him around me?
Yeah, not around you. He, early on, when we were just starting to do the weekly version of the Meltdown, before when we could have the back door open and there wasn't too many people going, he would always pull up in his car, like, midway through the show and just stand in the back from the back door, watch the whole show, laugh out loud, clap. And then once the show was done, get back in his car and leave. And one time, like, I went out, I was like, "Hey, you know you're more than welcome to sit on a seat. And he's like, nah, man, this is the way I like it. And and he's like, great show. And then took off. I was like, that's perfect. That's great.
Yeah, I know. He was a character. He's great. But, you know, that might have, you know, because when he finally got up on stage doing stand-up, he was storytelling. I wonder if he was actually learning there.
Yeah, it's possible, yeah.
He certainly didn't do Waka Waka up there.
No.
Where's your set tonight?
No, I'm not going.
Oh, I thought you were
No, I was just kidding. No, I'm going to go. I'm going to go hang out with my kid and get ready for another day of work.
Well, I think, it'll come and it'll go, you know. It sounds like you are unfortunately familiar with the process.
Yeah,
it'll come and it'll go, and I think it just means that it's, you know, it was special. And so, you know, I really, really appreciate that you came here. And it was just a weird coincidence that it happened to be this date.
Yeah.
In hindsight,
I don't know if I would have booked at midnight on tonight. I really didn't, but I also didn't know that I'd be sent for such a loop. Thanks for being so kind.
Of course. And if anyone else that you know has died, we'll book you on those dates, too.
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay, all right. Totally.
I'm only going to hang out with 20-year-olds. And Caitlin, you can be quiet.
Done and done.
All right, man. It's good to see you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondry app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondry Plus in the Wondry app or Wondry Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.